I am Rabbi David Katz, coincidentally the director of MNY, for those that have heard of it. It's coincidental because I'm here, now my second time that I've been asked every year, but actually made it to the Young Israel of Woodmere. It's such a great program, I'm happy to be a part of it. We have very limited time. They give you a half hour, that's how these things work, which is a little, as you'll see, counterintuitive for the topic that I'm going to do. I'm taking basically what's a sicha that I give in MMY, and it takes about an hour and a half, and I'm shrinking it down into a half hour, so please understand when I shorten things, that's where it comes from. I'm going to give you out a question that was posed a few years ago, probably a good 15 years ago already, on what was then an educators discussion email list. It was called LookJed, LookJed. It no longer exists in that format. You can still find stuff online. It's fascinating, and you can see all sorts of discussions that we, your children's educators, have had over the years on all sorts of issues. This particular question caught my eye, and I'll put out the question. If we had more time, we could actually discuss it. We don't. I'll tell you what the discussion was online, and we'll take it from there. So here, we'll just pass that around. There should be plenty. Here, we'll pass that around there. It's okay. And you get personally Lewis Hillary. There you go. Okay. It's the side that says I'm teaching an 11th grade Chumash class. For the purpose of the recording and for those that do better on audible learning rather than visual learning, here you go. I'm teaching 11th grade Chumash in a modern Orthodox high school. I'm not telling you where this is from. It was not from the New York area, so you don't have to think too far. Anyway, I am teaching 11th grade Chumash in a modern Orthodox high school. This year we're studying Sefer Dvarim. In the first semester, I have covered is in quotes, I have covered the first 11 prakim. I don't read much inside, but instead I have them read a perek at home or in shiur with guided questions. Class is generally focused on a theme and discussion revolves around this theme. At the end of the semester, I announce the final will cover those 11 prakim, and part of the test will include psukim, which they will have to translate and give the context. A student came over to me afterwards and said, quote, Rabbi, I can't take your final. I don't understand Hebrew. I can barely read a pasuk. He was amazed that I could actually follow along during Torah reading on Shabbat and understand what's being said. I tested him on a few psukim and saw he wasn't lying. He could not make out prefixes, suffixes, roots, etc. What should my goal be with this student? Should I change what I do in class? What about those students who can read Chumash on their own? My answer to the student, there are plenty of seats in the front, my answer to the student was to focus on 5 prakim and know those well, i.e. translation and context. I don't want to give up on teaching my class through a theme-based discussion and turning this into a pasuk-by-pasuk translation class. Is that the right answer? Now, as someone who has taught high school, which I have never done, full disclosure. But I can imagine as someone who teaches high school, this is always a problem. So if the tracking in the high school works, and we could debate whether tracking in a high school is good or not good, but let's assume there is tracking for better or for worse. So you would hope that this problem would be removed because you wouldn't have a group of students in any given track on such a different level that you have no way to teach and test them appropriately. But guess what? Either tracking doesn't always exist, again, for worse or for better, or tracking doesn't help, and this problem comes all the time. Even if we're not talking about tracking for a test, as a teacher, and now replace teacher with parent, because parents, first of all, are the primary teachers of their children, even if we dump them off from 9 to 5, well, from 8 to 5, well, 8 to, whatever, in somebody else's care in a classroom. Ultimately, the education of our children is our responsibility, number one. Number two, the messages that we send our children about what is appropriate learning methods and what are not, they pick up from us in terms of what we take interest in when our children come home with their studying, with their test, with their grades. And not to mention that we as parents, last I checked, at least in this country, we are the lay leadership of those schools. And it is us, the parents, and the families that ultimately, through the board that gets elected, I guess, by us, the parents, are ultimately the ones that have to set the community agenda for those children. So it's very nice to dump the responsibility onto this poor teacher who's grappling with this question. In the end of the day, bottom line, it still comes down to us, the parents. And therefore, if we had more time, I would take questions from the floor. We would discuss, we get our half hour, so we don't have that luxury. What is the appropriate message that the school board, the principal, the parents, work your way down the chain, should be sending this teacher? Should the teacher be focusing on text and reading ability? Or should the teacher be focusing on the ultimate message that he's trying to get across? I don't know how many of you were just in Rev Schechter's keynote. I'll quote one thing from there in case you were there, just to pinpoint this. Rev Schechter claims, and again, quote Rev Schechter Munach, it's obviously there, but you can debate that. He felt that if a teacher teaches, I'll just use the example he gave, the Kli Yakar that really tickles the teacher's fancy, but ignores the Perushim and Chumash that actually are ultimately more important because they show up in Shulchan Aruch and they become part of our halakha, etc., he felt that that was inappropriate chinuch. On the other hand, what if it's the Kli Yakar that I'm going to teach? Please. If the Kli Yakar that I'm going to teach is going to inspire, okay, so it's not the most important opinion or the most textual opinion or the most rooted, but it's a beautiful Jewish idea that's going to keep my child in the religious fold. Shouldn't I quote the Kli Yakar rather than sit there teaching the Rashi with all of the difficult textual nuances? So again, to put that in Rav Schechter's language from what he spoke about earlier. That's the question this teacher is asking. I'll just read to you what was suggested by someone on list. So this is coming from the LookJet archives. You can find on the archives, I actually was involved in the conversation, the original. I'm glad to see the issue of functional illiteracy, that's what this topic is called, functional illiteracy among yeshiva graduates has been raised. Having been involved in four very different yeshiva high schools over the past two decades, I have no doubt that a significant portion of yeshiva high school graduates are functionally illiterate. If we define it as the ability to read a passage from Ramban's Torah commentary or a Daf Gemara. The question I pose is what should be the realistic expectations of students studying complex texts in a non-native language and what the goals of a yeshiva education should be. If I were to use math as an analogy, the goal of high school education is not to produce mathematicians, but to introduce the field of higher mathematics to the broader population, give the students the fundamental tools with which they can explore math on a higher level, should they choose to do so, and provide the inspiration so that some students will indeed pursue advanced mathematics. I suspect that survey of high school graduates who have no intention of pursuing a course of study which requires advanced mathematical skills will retain much more than rudimentary algebra and geometry. Were we to apply the same standard to other subjects, such as history of the sciences, I believe that we would find results similar. This, of course, despite the fact that these subjects are being taught in a native language. Despite this, I don't believe we would consider these students as being functionally illiterate in these areas, because for the masses, there's no realistic expectation that these students would have mastered these skills. Honestly, how many of us remember the difference between molarity and molarity? Should we poll that? Anyway, molality, a proud memory. The difference between molarity and molality, or how to determine the height of a building using trigonometry. The analogy to Limudei Kodesh is fairly clear, despite the obvious differences. I'm going to skip a little bit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In light of the above, we must revisit the question of what are the reasonable goals of a yeshiva education. I remind you, not your teacher's goals. We as parents, these are our goals for our children and our community. So the question is for us. What are the reasonable goals of a yeshiva education? I believe that the answer must be formulated on a scale, with the higher goals reserved for the more intellectually gifted students. What follows, and if you flip over your page, I printed it for you, is my very rough draft, which some may see as a challenge, and I invite an online discussion to add, subtract, clarify, debate, refine it. This is a list that this person who wrote this response to the teacher who wrote the question suggested that we define our goals of a yeshiva education, plot them on a list. You can debate the list. You can say that something that somebody put as a higher goal is really less important. We could play that game if we had more time, all we would want to, and I do that in school when we have this conversation. Again, I said it's an hour and a half session, not a half hour. We could do that. And he says as follows. You can see graduates who achieve the first 8 goals may be functionally illiterate. And while I would optimally like for all students to achieve all of the above stated goals, I would not consider a yeshiva education a failure if the vast majority of our students emerge having achieved only the first 8, and to a lesser extent, some of the others. This was his suggestion. So again, if you flip over that page to his list, I'll just read it again for the benefit of those who benefit from that, and the
recording wherever that went. One, graduates should have positive feelings about their Jewish identity. Two, graduates should be open to continue to explore that identity beyond their formal schooling. Three, graduates should be committed to the fundamental values of Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael. Four, graduates should know how to function as active participants in their Jewish communities and communal institutions. Five, graduates should be committed to function as active participants in their Jewish communities and communal institutions. Six, graduates should be committed to a life of Shmirat Mitzvot. Seven, should appreciate the value and integrity of the process of Talmud Torah and be committed to incorporate some form of Jewish learning into their adult lives. Eight, graduates should be prepared to devote time post-graduation to continue their Jewish learning in a formal environment. That's where he cut the list and then said the rest are nice if you have the ability and time, but they become less important. Nine, graduates should have the language skills to decode classical Jewish texts. 10, graduates should have the critical thinking skills to appreciate the uniqueness and significance of those tests. I'm hearing Rav Schechter suffering even as we speak. 11, graduates should have the ability to analyze texts critically and offer their own suggestions for understanding them, also known as prepared Dvar Torah. 12, graduates should know how to research questions to find the appropriate sources in which they can find answers. And finally, 13, graduates should be aware of what types of questions they are incapable of answering and how to seek advice and guidance. So, without the time for discussion, how many, again, 8, 9, we could play, and again, you could always play with the order. How many feel that the answer that says that the first 8, we can't accomplish everything. There's only 38 minutes in a period. There's only 5 days in a week. There are, in this country, there are other things that kids need on their college resumes, extracurricular activities, which are also enriching, etc. And in the end of the day, we need to make sure that our kids are inspired and not just able to pull out their thumbs. If their thumbs have been exercised but their hearts have not been exercised, then what have we ultimately accomplished? They'll have a lot of textual knowledge, but where will they be? If that's true, and again, a show of hands, I'm not looking at anyone and I don't know you, so that's the advantage of speaking to in this forum. How many would agree with the suggestion of the person who wrote this that the top 8 become the key and afterwards we can play? The molarity guy agrees with that. How many of you disagree? Okay, pretty overwhelming as statistics go. Well, I can tell you that he got clobbered online. And here was the analogy. The analogy was, let's compare our demands from our Jewish education to our secular education. And this you can please pass around. Give me a little help over there, it'll go faster, and I'll send a batch to the back. It'll go faster. This was the analogy. Okay. The analogy goes, let's have a list of 8 goals for secular education, being the ones that are the minimal that we would expect of our schools and our children. And again, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 are great goals for your secular education, but there's only 5 days a week, and there's only 8 hours in a day, and there's extracurricular activities that are enriching and are very important, not only for the college resume, but it, you know, and if we spend our whole time in our secular education, I don't know if thumb here is the correct bone in the body to use, but if I teach our kids in chemistry or in math or in English literature, whatever, to use their thumbs but not to engage their heart, what have I really accomplished? That's the analogy, right? So here are the goals. One, graduates should have positive feelings about their American identity. Two, graduates should be open to continue to explore that sense of American identity beyond their formal schooling. Three, graduates should be committed to fundamental values of democracy and justice. Four, graduates should know how to function as active participants in their American communities and communal institutions. Five, graduates should be committed to function as active participants in the American communities and communal institutions. Six, graduates should be committed to a life of good citizenship and allegiance to the law. Seven, graduates should be appreciate the value of continued learning and be committed to incorporate some form of learning, be it in lectures, tapes, you can see how old this is, be it in lectures, tapes, or educational TV into their adult lives. Eight, graduates should be prepared to devote time post-graduation to continue their learning in a formal environment. I don't know what your reaction is. I'll read you the summation of the person who did this. He said, we'd be glad the graduates were productive citizens and not hoodlums, to be sure. But we look for another principal. Sadly, however,
wouldn't take court.
No, for sure. But what's interesting, and now you have to be honest, and you have to think about it in our Jewish community. And I speak here, I'm only speaking from my experience in one particular Israel yeshiva / seminary, but I find this to be an attitude that we inherit, us a little bit less because we are a text-based school, but an attitude that we inherit and we're fighting against and fighting against and fighting against, and there are times that we're just banging our heads against the wall. And if it's coming from the kids, I get that, because what kid wants to work in anything? It's bad enough they have to work in their secular department, so to convince them that it's worth their while to work in their Judaics and that it'll actually carry them and bring them somewhere, so from a kid's perspective, I get it. Parents, school boards, principals, teachers, and it just continues, and even when we get them into college and advanced Judaic studies, it's just simply the human nature of the generation, and that's why I rant on it for the 28 minutes that I have. And I'll just read you. Find the appropriate paragraph here. Yeah, here it is. There's a yeshiva kadosh in my neighborhood. Again, I don't know who's writing this. There's a yeshiva kadosh in my neighborhood that has a regents track to accommodate those parents who have not yet been convinced that there's no real value in having a high school diploma in our society. So obviously this is a right-wing place, give it a geography, whatever it is, where they don't yet have they have a regents track and that's it. They're being, they study English literature in class from cliff notes, not the original text. They're being prepared to be able to discuss the book on the regents exam without wasting time on reading the book itself. Now, if you think about that for a second, by the way, it makes us all chuckle, because I don't think any of us in this community would think that that's appropriate for our secular education. But now let me read that again, and again, with an honest look at our own Jewish communities, translate the secular into the Jewish, and before we laugh, maybe we're falling into the same trap. There's a yeshiva kadosh in my neighborhood that has a regents track to accommodate those parents who have not yet been convinced that there's no real value in having a high school diploma in our society. Again, translate. They study English literature in class from cliff notes, not the original text. They're being prepared to be able to discuss the book on the regents exam without wasting time on reading the book itself. It would be a mistake to assume that this disdain for the text is not being conveyed to students who are told that they can discuss Chumash without access to the original text. Of course, so-and-so, the guy who asked the original question, would prefer interesting discussion to drill in reading and grammar. Who wouldn't? But he's in this fix because all of the teachers before him had the same attitude. What would he do if he found that the discussions in his English literature class were based on Wishbone, a great elementary school TV show that introduces young children to famous books by way of a talking dog, because the students couldn't read the books under discussion? Or if he found that the students in his math class were discussing logical proofs but couldn't add fractions? I would hope that he would address the real deficiency. And if you're still not convinced that this problem exists in our schools, your schools, the ones that your children go to, I'll read one more paragraph. Hashkafa discussions, even when held on class time, are effective educational tools. I'll read that again. Hashkafic discussions, even when held on class time, are effective educational tools. But when they become a substitute for the hard work of mastering a subject, they constitute educational malpractice. No pain, no gain is no longer the motto of secular education in our society. Our rabbeim have unfortunately bought into this new attitude. And when you hear this, or when I read this, it rings so true. You've only got 38 minutes. You've got 5 days a week. Most Judaic classes are not all 5 days a week. In schools where they teach Gemara, not every school teaches Gemara, certainly depending on the gender. If they're teaching Gemara, the amount of hours that need to be spent to do anything in Gemara, my gosh, Rav Schachter just spoke about how you need context of all of Shas. And even if you're going to teach Chumash, you also now need to teach all of Shas, because otherwise you won't understand the Pshat and Chumash. So you get to do that in 38 minutes, 2 days a week, depending on the school schedule, when really what's on the kid's mind is the math test that they have in the next period, unless it happens to be that the school has all their Judaics in the morning and all their secular in the afternoon, or vice versa, so at least they stand half a chance of being focused. what's on the kid's mind is most likely the pressure that they're going to get from their parents for success in, because we all know the pressures of getting into university, the pressure, and what's left. And this starts already from a very young age. It should be no surprise to any of us that by the time we get the kids into 12th grade, they've already checked out. And then that perpetuates, because that's going to set already what yeshiva or what seminary they wind up in, or even can apply to, and finish the spiral, and then you wonder. And therefore, I want to spend these few minutes that I had to focus us, again, as the ultimately the lay leadership, as ultimately the people that set the agenda of our children's school, starting in kindergarten and going all the way through, what should be our goals for our education? Are our goals for our education that they should walk out feeling fuzzy about their Judaism, which is important? They need to walk out feeling fuzzy about their Judaism. I will not debate that. The question is, what message are we sending them by taking the shortcut to the fuzz, which doesn't last, and shortchanging them on the actual education that it takes to get there? I'll read you a couple other comments, and hopefully we'll have time for some questions at the end. I'm keeping an eye. I got 6 minutes. Okay, so I'll read you one more thing. Here are some suggestions. And of course, I can't find my notes. Here they are. Okay. I'll make the following suggestion. Ultimately, what we want to teach our kids is to tap into the beauty of the Masorah. If we can get them to tap into the beauty of the Masorah, the details become less important. I don't know if they're going to walk out of high school knowing every single Rashi and Chumash and every single Halach and Shulchan Aruch. That I don't know. That would be an unrealistic goal. Again, Rav Schechter's comments aside, I think that would be an unrealistic goal. But if I can tap them into the Masorah, then I think I stand half a chance of making them feel connected and fuzzy and warm about their religion, but yet giving them the tools for continued growth with all the same message. And again, it doesn't have to be Torah Sheba Al Peh. Again, Rav Schechter spoke specifically about Torah Sheba Al Peh, and as an aside, as he was saying that, I was wondering if he would have had the exact same message for women and men, or if that was very male-focused, and when he spoke, I didn't get to ask him. I mean, I've had a lot of personal conversations with him on this topic over the last 25 years, so I'm pretty sure I know his position. But, so it might have been a little male-centric. So, but how do we get people to tap into the Masorah? And I think the way we get people to tap into the Masorah is by actually teaching Torah. Not just about Torah, not just fuzzy warm messages, not just the good kliyaka that serves my religious agenda in that particular pasuk and chumash, but like Rav Schechter spoke about in his keynote, to understand that there's a process. It's called Torah Sheba Al Peh. Rashi's also Torah Sheba Al Peh. It's not just Gemara. And therefore, this doesn't have to be gender specific in any way. Yes, no, we can debate. But to tap people into the Masorah. And that I'll just read you one small little piece here. This comes from Rav Yair Kahn, who happens to be the head of the Gush one-year Shana Aleph program for Americans, on this topic. He wrote this a million years ago. But he wrote the following. If formalistic learning is irrelevant, why did the greatest Talmudic minds engage in it? If learning must be connected to spirituality or philosophy worthy of involvement, why did the Rav Zitzal spend so much energy when he was feeble and sick on such unworthy endeavors as solving pshat in a difficult Rambam that had no ulterior message? The basic assumption of the irrelevance of learning per se without greater spiritual or philosophic content is far off the mark. This is well known to anyone with the sense of Masorah, who continues to walk in the path forged by the Gedolei Olam. To them, the world of Torah, which is the revealed words of Hashem, as transmitted and translated by the Chachmei HaMasorah, is relevant, by definition. Involvement in and submission to this word is a profound religious act. Being creative and attempting to define these divine categories in human terms is an exciting and dynamic act of human involvement and passing on the revealed word throughout the generations. This is the message which I received from Mori Barabi, the Rav Zitzal, as I sat in his shir, while he grappled with formalistic problems. This spiritual and philosophical giant, weakened by age and poor health, would enter the classroom and begin barely at a whisper. As the shir progressed, while dealing with irrelevant formalistic details, he began to get stronger. His mind began to focus. He was able to draw from some mysterious pool of strength as the shir continued for over 2 hours. Talmidim tired way before he did, but he wasn't dealing with things irrelevant to his life. Pshat in the Rambam was his life. The pool from which his strength was drawn was a spiritual one, because Torah Sheba'al Peh, the revealed world of Hashem, was his life. Obviously, the choice of topics. Obviously, which perushim you use. Obviously, which masechta you teach, in what order you teach them, again, to quote Rav Schechter from earlier, and how is all the challenge that the teacher has in the classroom, no doubt. But I would hope that the expectation that we have from our schools, and therefore of our children, is not just that they should be, I want to make sure they stay frum at all costs. Yes, we would like them to stay frum at almost all costs. I would agree with that. But if the cost is going to be their connection to, abilities in, and affinity to the text, then the investment of what's going to be 10 years down the pike when they're in third grade and in fourth grade, and we're not thinking that far ahead, when they go to college and they see that math and science has depth and suddenly Torah doesn't, if we think that through a little bit further in advance, we'll see that we need to have our children engaged and given the tools to handle text, to master it, and to understand the depth of that text so that they continue to tap in to the Masorah. Comments? Yes, please.
So, as kids progress, I think the secret, you know, when you find, you know, a lot of us have been teaching high school, and the big issue when you have a ninth grader, a 10th grader, you realize they can't read, or they can barely read, is don't make it punitive. Just talk to them privately and say, I'm not going to make it punitive that you can't read Rashi, or that you can barely read Hebrew. I mean, I wouldn't put it that way. I'll work with you privately, and it's okay, no one has to know, and I'm going to help you get your reading up to par. It's not going to affect your grade at all. I just want your skills to move up. And I think when you express to students that it's not going to affect their grade, I just want you to get better at this, you can do it and you're amazing, when it's not going to affect their grade, they are going to want to improve their skills. And that's really the key in the higher grades, middle school and high school, to motivating them, because that's really the issue. They just don't want their grades to be affected.
Right. I would definitely agree with that.
I think that's important.
I would definitely agree with that. We've all moved on from a generation of in the old days, you know, the discipline that probably we all received from our parents was the 1960s discipline. 1960s discipline doesn't work in anything anymore. So if 1960s discipline doesn't work in anything anymore, it's not going to work in our education either. Somehow in secular education, that is still a motivator because there's the next level. And when it comes to Judaic studies, again, the yeshiva seminary acceptance issues aside, there is no next level. Everything becomes optional. And because of that, we lose that card, so to speak, which doesn't work in society anymore anyway. What I have found, though, is the opposite extreme happens. It's all good. And then there's no ramification whatsoever on the kid, because if there's no grade and there's no next level, then what do we gain? So that I don't teach high school. I'll leave that to you. But the concept, and I think it starts from a much younger age. I'm speaking about high school, but I'm telling you it starts already in kindergarten. I'll tell you a quick story. I once was in an elementary school, and the elementary school principal called me over to yell at me. Why was he yelling at me? He does that. Girls, when they come back from Israel, don't know Hebrew, and therefore he can't get good Hebrew teachers. And he was yelling at me. So I turned to him and I said, and you know why we can't teach the kids Hebrew anymore? Because the high schools don't teach Hebrew anymore. And do you know why the high schools don't teach Hebrew anymore, if you ask their principals? Because the elementary schools don't teach Hebrew anymore. And do you know why the elementary schools don't teach Hebrew anymore? Because the seminaries are not teaching. Thank you. So there's a spiral in our Jewish education, in particular in Hebrew language, which is a key to learning that, again, far be it from me to solve. But I do think that we have to, just the subliminal messages we send our children at home when they give a Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table. And it is just a nice message. It's not even based anymore on a Pasuk and Chumash. NCSY, I don't blame NCSY, but quote-unquote, I like to blame, quote-unquote, blame NCSY for this, that Dvar Torah became a nice motivating story, as opposed to Vayadaber Hashem al Moshe Le'emor. How about start, give me just that? But it doesn't work that way in our society anymore, and I think that has to change. Yeah?
Do you think our goals are different now than we were several generations ago? When I grew up, there was no art scroll, there was no translations. If you know Hebrew, you were lost, totally lost. Nowadays, you have translations, and it's a little bit easier to motivate people, a little easier to go through a chumash without it.
Right, so I think it's a carrot and a stick, because on the one hand, it's a crutch, and if we put an art scroll in front of a kid already in kindergarten, that's all they're ever going to do. On the other hand, those tools are tremendous, because, yes, you can. If you have a kid who's batting their head against the wall and they can't accomplish anything, you also have nothing. So I don't have the perfect answers, but I do think that, like everything else in life, there's a balance there. For certain things, you use the crutch because your goal is to get straight through and get to the message. I wouldn't, again, I don't know who I'm speaking to, but I would never think to use an English translation in a school setting, no different than you wouldn't use a French translation in a French classroom. You've got to teach them French. So I think there's a difference between in school, out of school, extracurricular learning, in curricular, some classes, not others. I don't have the answers. I only have the questions, but I think it's important to start with questions. Yeah.
The question is how to get kids to buy into it. I bought it, but you get such resistance. I just can't, I won't. Grit, working on something, the idea that you have to read something, and it's true in English, I teach English as well. You read something more than once to understand it. I don't understand it after one time, and that's it. So that to me is the
right. So they say that you can't change a culture. And this is a cultural phenomenon. It's not just Jewish.
Right,
this is a cultural phenomenon. Blame it on the smartphones, the internet, we can go on, right? And you can't change a culture. You have to embrace the culture and work with it. See, that's where I disagree. I think you can change a culture. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think that it starts with the educational system, which starts by the lay leadership, which starts from the parents. And if we start changing schools, one class at a time, so it may take 20 years. I don't want to be standing here 20 years from now and continuing the trend that I see as being a spiral down. I want to be able to catch it and move
back. What do you do in seminary?
So different seminaries do different things, and I do think there needs to be different. I happen to teach in a specific one, correct. I'm just saying there are different types of kids and there are different needs, and therefore to say that everybody should be in one stroke, I don't think is fair. I do think that there could be different styles and different, you know, et cetera, and let the market in that level determine where kids go. That having been said, again, different types of classes, different types of kids. When somebody gives a shiur klali, for example, a general shiur, to have a photocopy on a page that has English on the side, I don't think is a crime. I would never use an English translation in my classroom. So that's the difference between the type of class, the specific goal of that particular class. If there's opportunities for textual study versus other classes where it's not meant for that, it's more frontal. So if you mix and match and do different things, again, depending on the level of your kids, I'm worried about the message. So in my seminary, even if somebody pulls out an English translation, no one will ever claim that the culture as a culture in the seminary that I run is a non-text culture. So once I've covered the politics and the marketing, now I can do some non-textual things as well. And you can do the spiritual, and you can motivate, and you can do all of those things, but the culture has been set. And I'm not sure that in our community we've set the bar in the appropriate place, and thus my message. One last comment, and then I have to let you go, or I'm not being fair to the next speaker.
I feel like part of the issue is not so much, and I feel like we're talking extreme, where sometimes you're looking at meaning and relevance. You need to detect the kids have to feel why there's some relevance in what you're learning to them, not necessarily discussing spiritual versus textual.
Absolutely, which is why the topics that you choose to teach and then turn those textual are important.
Right.
Which is why, to use Rav Schechter's metaphor, I wouldn't necessarily start on Daf Bet. If you're going to wallow on Daf Bet, so start with Daf Vav. Why do you have to start on Daf Bet? Meaning the choice of curriculum, what topics you teach, what order you teach them, how the ebb and flow of the year goes. We're often so connected to the calendar that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are very exciting to us, but they may be a little boring to the kids. So I'm just making an example. I don't know if it's true. I'm just saying. So maybe all I'm saying is a little creative thought in the classroom and how you, but not at the expense. Again, if you use the analogy of your secular education, and use that in our Torah education.
You also have that, but you don't have the secular education. If the kids graduate, they take physics, you don't have a not
love. Yeah, don't say that's what this is. Correct. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is obviously the larger topic than my half hour allows. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your attention. I hope it raises the question. Mm-hmm.